This episode of Inside EMS Podcast is sponsored by LogRx. Learn a better way to track your narcotics at LogRx.com.
Well, here it is. We are back another week. It's all about life, love, and the pursuit of happiness and going inside EMS. And we've got tons to talk about today. And here he is. You can see him. The slimmed down version of the man we call Kelly Grayson. Kelly Grayson, KG, you're looking good, man. How you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm the lightest I've been in 10 years. Still not where I want to be. But yeah, Nancy was remarking on that the other day that I look much thinner. Feeling a heck of a lot better. I'm feeling better than I did before my pulmonary embolus, which is the last week was the 1 year anniversary of that. So doing pretty good, man. I'll get in the pool and I'll swim laps for an hour without rest. I managed to do that the other day. I don't swim fast. I swim a 25 meter lap in about 45 to 50 seconds, but I'm still swimming and it's burning off a bunch of calories. So doing good.
Well, that's the way to work it, you know. I mean, I think as we get older, you know, we have trouble with trying to keep ourselves in shape and trying to keep ourselves, you know, with a good weight. And one of the things that I did as I started to sneak up on the scale myself was I cut out all raw sugar. And I'm probably about 25 days into that. So when I say raw sugar, like I may have a cup of coffee in the morning, so I'll add some sugar to that, but I'm talking about soda. Yeah. Candy, you know, cakes, cookies, things like that. And I've lost about 12 pounds in 25 days just doing that and nothing else, right? And I think Monday I'm going to start cutting out the breads and the pastas and see what that does. But nothing really. And I think we use the term diet too much. It's not really about diet.
Everybody it needs say, to be a oh, lifestyle change.
It really is how you eat, right? I mean, so if I want to have a cup of coffee, I'll have a cup of coffee. If I want to eat a bowl of pasta, I'll eat a bowl of pasta. I just need to, at my age, I just can't do it every day anymore. But then physical fitness, as you say, has to be part of that as well. As you start to get older, you know, arthritis in my hands and all the things that are going on, you know, when do we start taking care of ourselves and taking ourselves seriously that we're not going to have a problem?
I had been out of the pool for about 2 months. It had been in teaching the paramedic class at Clark's, and I wasn't able to swim as often as I wanted to. And then for the last 2 months, I hadn't been in the pool at all. And Nancy was worried about my eating habits because I wasn't counting my calories quite as strictly as I had when I was steadily working out. And I stepped back on the scale when I got back in the pool, and I was 0.25 pounds heavier than when I had stopped. So that's fine. I don't do the low carb thing and the no raw sugar thing. I simply just count calories. I keep my calorie limit below a certain minimum. And the way I do that is, of course, you can't keep your calorie count low if you eat calorie dense foods, which is high carbs and high fats and that sort of thing. So I can't do things like, you know, working on an ambulance. I can't cut out processed meals and stuff, but I eat the healthy choice frozen stuff. And instead of snacking on a bag of Ho-Hos or frosted donuts, you know, I'll get some Paninos or something like that.
And how do you pick those? How do you pick the calories that you're gonna? Is there a calculation or something that you use? Because you're a bigger guy, right? So if I can't eat calories that you're gonna eat, because it would just be out of whack for me. But how do you determine?
My physical or my calorie goal on my fitness tracker is 2,292 calories a day or 2,290 calories a day. And I try to keep it under 1,500. I don't sweat if I hit 1,700 or 1,800, but you know, I try to keep it under 1,500. I drink a protein shake for breakfast, 160 calories. For lunch, I eat a healthy choice meal or something along those, and those were anywhere from 190 to 270 calories, depending on which flavor meal I'm eating. And then for lunch, Nancy cooks me something lovely for dinner, and I may get 400 or 500, 600 calories in dinner, and throw in a snack here and there in between. And usually the snack is going to be either a packet of tuna and 6 Triscuits Or, which I have simple tastes. That doesn't bother me at all. I can eat a pack of tuna and six Triscuits and be satisfied. Prosciutto paninos, a little prosciutto wrapped around a mozzarella stick. And it
Oh,
works great,
interesting.
you know. And I've dropped about 85 pounds since October, and close to 100 pounds since April. So
Very nice. Well,
last
good,
April.
man.
So
Awesome.
yeah.
So as
So
we were talking before and doing some show prep, there's a couple things inside EMS that's giving you a little bit of heartache, huh?
yeah. It's, you know, one of them is, and I don't think it's really heartache, but there's a case in Paterson, New Jersey, where a case has finally come to court, and the pathologist, or a pathologist who was hired by the family to investigate the cause of death for Jameek Lowry, back in 2019, stated that it was due to in ambulance homicide.
Well, hang on a second.
Some background, Mr. La yeah.
let me add something. He's not just a
Yeah.
pathologist. He is the
He
pathologist.
is Michael Bodden. Yeah,
Yeah.
he's the one that's the actor
O.J.
Ferguson.
Simpson,
The
yeah,
family called
Ferguson,
him in.
Missouri. Yeah. So he's one of the foremost pathologists in the United States.
He's a very well known. He is like the Neil deGrasse Tyson of forensic pathologists.
If you want to
Very
go there,
popular.
if you want to go there, go ahead.
The background on this, yeah, the background on this is Jameek went to St. Joseph's Hospital in 2019 for help. He was high on drugs, and he became agitated and scuffled with security, and they kicked him out. Then he arrived at the police station barefoot, did a Facebook live video in which he screamed the police were going to kill him, and then the police accompanied him in an ambulance back to the hospital and attempted to restrain him, and he supposedly was in cardiac arrest and then died 2 days later. And he was under the influence of bath salts, and sparked a lot of protests. Naturally, he was in custody of police and paramedics at the time, but they ruled it a death due to active psychosis, or as we used to call it, excited delirium, because he was under the influence of bath salts. The family contracted Dr. Michael Bodden to do a secondary autopsy. And he found evidence of blunt force trauma to the face, jaw, arms, and chest, and compressive force, and ruled that it was a homicide. And has from what we read, you know, all the earmarks of a restraint death. So once again, this is another incident. Now, this happened in 2019. Hopefully these things will be less frequent as time goes on, but there's another case where they're blaming both the police officers and the paramedics who were transporting this gentleman for his death.
You know, and one of the things that we talked about is more and more we're starting to see this now. Elijah McClain, you know, certainly the paramedics in Springfield, Illinois, that are up on homicide charges. And we knew that there was now going to be a waterfall of these things happening. When people need to point a finger and they need to blame somebody, they're going to start blaming EMS and police and fire more for the deaths of the people who are not making it to the hospital or that are truly deserved, Kelly, that, you know, certainly, you know, as an armchair quarterback, I think that there were some mistakes made in Springfield, you know, but when we think about this now, this is a 4-year-old case, as you mentioned, that's finally getting to court, that people are pointing the fingers at, you know, the EMS providers and the police that there was some unprofessionalism and probably some murder. But one of the things that I want to touch on as well, and I don't really know, I'm kind of giving you the reins of where you want this to go. Sometimes we just let loose and say, all right, Kelly, take us down this path and, you know, as we do show prep. But one of the things that I want to put into this is when does EMS have the authority or have the courage to stop our police partners from maybe doing things they shouldn't be doing for years? And I just told the story last night, so I'll share this story. When I was working for an EMS agency, I got a call for an inhalation. And you know that inhalation is either sometimes carbon monoxide poisoning or some type of gas in the home, or when a patient has been maced by the police, right? So I told a story yesterday that I got on scene and there was someone in the police car, so I automatically assumed that incorrectly that it was karma, that it was Mace. So the guy was screaming at the cop, "I'm going to kill you. I know where you live. I'm going to kill your family," and blah, blah, blah. So the window was cracked a little bit, and the cop says to the patient, he says, "All right," he goes, "if you stop and relax, I'll give you the antidote and you'll be okay." And I'm thinking to myself, antidote? What the heck's the antidote? And he says, "Come over here and open your eyes." So the guy comes over to the window and he opens his eyes and as much as he can, and the cop maces him again. So
Oh.
when we think about that, what was my responsibility to say, "Hey, you shouldn't be doing that"? Of course, at the time when we go back to this, which was the early 2000s, I didn't say a word, right? But that
Yeah.
was my failure of, the police doing things they shouldn't have done. There was no reason that that should have happened. But instead, I may have, I took the path to say, "Well, you got what you deserve." But,
Yeah.
that's been our mentality as EMS providers, is to say, we're there to back the blue, we're there to back the red.
Yeah.
We may not be, if we're supposed to be patient advocates, where was my duty to stand up to say, "Yo, whoa, whoa, what are you doing?"
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So as we now talk about this, and as we now may implicate the paramedics in this for in ambulance homicide, where is our responsibility to say we did the wrong thing here?
And now let's pause for a word from our sponsor.
Designed and founded by EMS professionals, LogRx provides real-time accountability of all your narcotics from cradle to grave. Reach out today for a demo and download the app on the iTunes and Google Play stores. And coming soon, LogRx will also track your medical supplies, equipment, PPE, and even vehicle checks. For more information, visit logrx.com. That's LogRx.com.
Professionally, I've always identified more with police officers than I have with firefighters. It seems to me, my perception of EMS and law enforcement, we're more similar than we are different. Mobile, largely autonomous, problem solvers have to kind of do it on the fly sometimes, whereas, there is no room for improvisation on the fire ground. So I've always, even though fire's traditionally been EMS providers in many areas, I've always felt more kinship with the cops than I have with the firefighters. However, as you grow and mature a little bit as a provider, you and hopefully become a better patient advocate, you realize there are some things that the police officers do, and it's not all. It's a tiny fraction of police officers, but there are some that are not good with people, and for whatever reason, they got into law enforcement, and they make problems worse. And in those situations, we have to kind of divorce our kinship from the boys in blue and remember first and foremost that we are patient advocates and not there to help the police officers do their job. We're there to care for the patient while that's going on. So, we've said it in this podcast before that your job is not to sedate someone because it makes the law enforcement officer's job easier. Your job is to sedate someone if it is medically appropriate. And in this case, I don't know. I wasn't in the back of that ambulance. I would say, however, that we need to have all avenues of restraint open to us and use medically appropriate means. Biden's report said that this guy had signs of compressive choking. He had broken fingers that were not documented in the county prosecutor's report. So he had a number of injuries that look rather suspicious, and quite often they can be a result of physical restraint. Now, that physical restraint might have been necessary. But Chris, why are paramedics there if physical restraint was the only thing that was necessary? Why have us? Cops are well versed in physical restraint, has specific training in it. When we do not, it's our job to make sure that strength restraint is done appropriately and safely for the patient. No prone, no dog piling, that sort of thing. But to move on, to be able to appropriately move on to chemical restraint when it's necessary. Would Jamil have been in better shape if they had moved on to chemical restraint? We don't know. But it kind of it illustrates the delirium. You know, in Colorado earlier this month, they banned use of excited delirium in training and in actual practice for EMS providers. And ASAP has long said that we shouldn't be using the term excited delirium. It's not in the DSM-5 refined psychological condition and so on and so forth. Now, I think the preferred terminology is hyperactive delirium with extreme agitation. You know, it's semantics. The push to go away from the term excited delirium was because it was viewed by many advocates as being a catch-all justification for excessive force by police officers. I don't know that that's the case. I don't think it's a convenient justification for excessive force. I think it is an unfortunate byproduct of police officers not having the adequate training to deal with these people, and they are left to the only training and knowledge that they have been supplied with. And often it's a blunt instrument that's not wielded expertly. So better training probably, I don't think it's anything nefarious on the police officer's part to justify beating someone to death or whatever. I think it's just a product of poor training. So
I do want to say,
call it, it's a phenomenon.
Yeah. I mean, whatever we talk about, you know, we have a pathologist report that's saying something nefarious happened in the ambulance. We don't know that for sure. So we're just kind of speculating in the sense of talking generally. We're not pointing a finger specifically at Paterson, New Jersey. But one of the questions that I want to ask you, Kelly, is I kind of gave the scenario to say that as providers, as EMS providers, when do we step in and put our hand on the back of a police officer to say, this is too much?
Stop.
Exactly. Yeah. But then if we do that, where is the fear that that police officer will give us the force protection we need when we're on scene, right? So now we've got to balance this to say, we're pointing a finger at our police partners to say, this isn't cool. You need to stop. This could be possibly criminal. And three or four calls later, 2 days from now, whatever it is, that same police officer is going to fold his arms and walk away when we may need their assistance. Now, I'm not here to say that that is the behavior of police officers, but I think that that could be my fear that when I need them, they're not going to be there for me. So this is a very, very interesting subject that we have to be able to find some crossroad to do what's right for the patient, or to say, I may not get help when I need it.
Yeah, I think the key to managing those situations is simply professionalism and de-escalation, the same that we would use when a patient is being inappropriate or violent or aggressive, and we try to de-escalate the situation. I think that, you know, in those situations, emotions tend to run high, and we're no more immune to it than police officers are. You remember the story that we covered in the podcast where the EMT had been spit on by a teenage patient, and she flipped out, absolutely acted a fool, and started beating the heck out of the kid in full view of police with their body cameras on. And the police rightfully pulled this person out and said, hey, get control of yourself. Calm down. It's a kid, and he spit on you. And of course, she was hearing none of it. But we're not immune from reacting emotionally, just like police officers are. And I think the best thing for us to do is to react like that police officer did in that case, and just de-escalate and speak calmly and try to remain professional and divorce our actions from our emotions when this goes on. It's hard to do sometimes, but we have to remember that we are the patient advocates. And when, you know, we're supposed to be the voices of reason and calm things down after that has occurred. You know, it's hard. You mentioned the case that you had. I remember early on in my career, I was a brand new paramedic, and we had a patient, small town, drunk, acting an idiot, being aggressive and hostile to the arresting police officer. And He was like, "I know you. I know where you live." And he recited his address and said he would rape his wife. Yeah, threatened to rape his wife and his daughter and all of this kind of stuff. Just vile stuff. And you know, this is beyond the pale of even an intoxicated person talking smack. And I'm looking over at the police officer, and he is just boiling. And I was about to start an IV on the guy, and I had a liter bag of saline in my hand, and I just thwacked it into my palm and left it on the bench seat of the ambulance and said, "You know what? I forgot something outside." And I don't know what happened in that ambulance, but it was noisy, and the ambulance was rocking. When I came back in the ambulance, the drunk patient was docile and far less likely to talk a bunch of smack. That was inappropriate on my part. You know, but I was a 25-year-old, 1-year paramedic who you know still was kind of reticent about going against the police and that thing. And I really didn't have the emotional tools to deal with a situation like that. And still don't to some extent, man. I don't speak belligerent drunk well, but I know that about myself. And when I have a belligerent drunk and it's a BLS patient, someone with a calmer head takes care of the patient and I drive. And that's been the division of labor with my partners. And I was like, "Hey, I don't speak belligerent drunk well. I tend to get nasty too. So I'm going to get myself out of the situation. And you, being a calmer head, can take care of the patient. He doesn't need ALS care, and I'll get up front and drive and you holler if you need help." And that's the way we've done that. You know, 25, 26 years ago, I wasn't mature enough to do that.
Yeah, but still, I mean, but now we need to think about the transition because it may be that you or I are going to be named in this homicide because we were there and we were complicit and we didn't do anything to stop it. And the question is going to be, how do we now make that transition to stand up for the advocacy to say, this is too much? I mean, when we think about the George Floyd situation in Minneapolis, there was an off-duty EMT, if my memory serves me right,
Telling
that
him
was
stop.
actually saying, trying to be the advocate. And but you know, the authority there was saying that it didn't make a difference. So this is something we're going to have to follow. This is something we're going to have to think about developing education. This is something that really is going to put us in a situation that we have to be able to do things a little bit differently. But man, I don't know the answer, Kelly, but give us your final thought. Let's get up on out of here today.
Well, I think overall we are there for patient care. Whether the patient is consenting to that care or is in a mental state to give informed consent to that care is immaterial. We're there to provide patient care. And if that patient care requires sedation or physical restraint for the safety of both the patient first and the caregivers, then we need to do that. And we need to use every tool in our arsenal. And if you, I think this might be in New Jersey a case of if physical restraint is the only thing you limit yourself to, the only option you consider available, bad things can sometimes happen. And remember that we're there for the patient, not for the convenience of the police officers. But that's what I think. We want to know what you think. Give us your thoughts at the show at EMS1.com. Don't forget to rate us on iTunes. Or for myself and co-host Chris Ceballero, thanks for tuning in to Inside EMS. Going to catch you guys next week.